last week, when I was talking to Sister Elizabeth Berry at the Day with the Word, when she heard that I was going to be exhorting today, she requested that we sing hymn 289 because she knew her mother was coming and she wanted us to sing it because it was her mother's favorite hymn. And I happily complied, especially because I knew it was one of my favorite hymns as well. But then I was thinking about, well, if that's going to be my exhortational hymn, then my exhortation really needs to be about what the hymn is. And I figured, well, let's delve into what is this hymn talking about. I didn't actually know that well what it was saying. It sounded beautiful, but the language was kind of old. What's the history? What's it really getting at here? And I also remembered that a long time ago, way back at Ewan Road in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, I had heard a public lecture where someone had talked for an hour about the author of the second tune of hymn 299. And I still remember that lecture. He had like the tune written on his gravestone and everything. He showed pictures. So if someone can talk for an hour about the author of the second tune of hymn 299, I figured we could probably delve into hymn 289 and find some stuff there that's worth hearing about. So this morning's exhortation is going to be on hymn 289. We're going to look at why it was written, what it's saying, and most importantly, what that means to our lives. And hopefully the next time you get to sing hymn 289, you'll better understand what you're singing. I certainly am going to better understand it after doing the research for this exhortation. So whenever you want to sort of research what's going on with a hymn, a reasonable place to start is the back of your hymn book. You didn't know, in the green hymn book, we didn't have it in the previous versions, but in the green book, we have source details by hymn number. So you can go to source details by hymn number, look up hymn 289, and you'll find that according to the back of the green hymn book, the words were written by William Osborne Starr, that means he was a Christadelphian, and the music was by Unknown. Unfortunately, though, that's actually wrong. Because if you do another useful research method, which is type in the first line of the hymn into Google, you'll be able to find who wrote it. And it turns out that it was actually, there's this poem called A Rose Shall Bloom in a Lonely Place, written by a certain John Gardner Calkins Brainard, a moderately successful American poet. And it was published in 1825 in Occasional Pieces of Poetry by John G.C. Brainard, which you can find on Google Books, the original 1825 edition, which has almost exactly the words of our hymn. So 1825, by the way, is the same year that, according to the back of the green hymn book, William Osborne was born. So William Osborne probably didn't write the words to this hymn. But then the question becomes, why does the back of our hymn book say that William Osborne wrote the words for this hymn? Because clearly they were written but the same year he was born, so he didn't write the words. But what's going on here? If you do a little more research, you'll find out that William Osborne was apparently the very first Christadelphian in Tewkesbury, a small town in England a little southwest of Birmingham. I had no idea where it was, so I had to look it up on Google Maps, but maybe those of us with better British knowledge know where Tewkesbury is. Apparently there was a famous Battle of Tewkesbury in the War of the Roses that occurred there. Anyway, there is still a Tewkesbury Ecclesia, and cool story, apparently this Tewkesbury Ecclesia leased this particular spot for their Bible Learning Center, and after they leased it, they found out that it was the original grocery store that William Osborne had owned when he was a Christadelphian, the first Christadelphian in Tewkesbury, and that Robert Roberts himself had slept in that grocery store, or rather a little apartment above the grocery store, because he'd stayed with William Osborne when he was doing a public lecture in Tewkesbury. So basically what all this comes down to is William Osborne was a real person. He was a real Christadelphian in Tewkesbury. And apparently it's known in England that William Osborne wrote hymn 289. But if he didn't write the words, then what did he write? Well, you may notice that in the back of the hymn book it says unknown for who wrote the music. And if you go searching for A Rose Shall Bloom in a Lonely Place, you'll find lots of references to the poem, But if you look for it as a hymn, you'll basically only find Christadelphian sources for it. You'll find a few odd ones out there. There's actually a YouTube recording of the Choir of the Scots International Church in Rotterdam, the Netherlands, performing it. But if you look through their thing, they perform all sorts of random stuff. But other than that, basically as a hymn, it's only known as Christadelphians. You won't find it in any of the hymn databases or anything. So what I'm pretty sure happened was that William Osborne found this poem in perhaps that original occasional pieces of poetry by John C. Brainard. Was like, this is a brilliant rendition to poetry of the scripture we have in Isaiah 35. Let's set it to music, wrote the music for it, and that's how we got A Rose Shall Bloom in our hymn books. So feel free to, you know, correct the back of your hymn book. But that, as far as I can tell, is the actual origins of our hymn. John Brainard wrote the words, and William Osborne wrote the music. So now that we've established that, who is this John Brainard guy, despite having an awesome last name? Well, fortunately, because he's this moderately popular American poet, and American poets get people who write all sorts of things about them, there's quite a lot of information. He was born in 1796 to a judge in Connecticut. He initially practiced law, but he didn't really like law because he had the soul of a poet. So he ended up instead becoming the editor of a newspaper called the Connecticut Mirror. And that newspaper actually didn't do very well because, again, he had the soul of a poet, so business was not his thing. But he did take the opportunity to publish several of his poems there. And after he'd been publishing poems in his newspaper, people really liked his poems, and they asked him to publish a book. So he published a book, that Occasional Pieces of Poetry by John C. Brainard, where he put in that book the poems he'd published in his newspaper plus a few other ones. And like I was saying, Google has archived the original book from 1825, so you can read it online. And you can go through there and you can find this hymn in that book from 1825. So I'm going to read the original from 1825. If you want, you can turn up hymn 289 and follow along. And you can see where it's the same and where it's different. So I'm going to be reading the original poem entitled Isaiah, 35th chapter. And it is from Occasional Pieces of Poetry by John G.C. Brainard. A rose shall bloom in the lonely place. A wild shall echo with sounds of joy. For heaven's own gladness its bounds shall grace, and forms angelic their songs employ. And Lebanon cedars shall rustle their boughs, and fan their leaves in the scented air. And Carmel and Sharon shall pay their vows, and shout, for the glory of God is there. O say to the fearful, be strong of heart. He comes in vengeance, but not for thee. For thee he comes, his might to impart, to the trembling hand and the feeble knee. The blind shall see, the deaf shall hear, the dumb shall raise their notes for him. The lame shall leap like the unharmed deer, and the thirsty shall drink of the holy stream. And the parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land a dew-washed mead. And where the wildest beasts held rule, the harmless of his fold shall feed. There is a way, and a holy way, where the unclean foot shall never tread. But from it the lowly shall not stray, to it the penitent shall be led. No lion shall rouse him from his lair, nor wild beast raven in foaming rage, but the redeemed of the earth shall there pursue their peaceful pilgrimage. The ransom of God shall return to him, with the chorus of joy to an angel's lay, with a tear of grief shall no eye be dim, for sorrow and sighing shall flee away. So that's the original poem. As you probably noticed, the first few verses are practically identical. And then it drops three verses, because otherwise we would probably have an eight-verse hymn, which would be kind of long. But it then comes back for the last verse, which is basically the same. So, as you can tell, the hymn actually has not changed much since 1825. If you're wondering why the language seems kind of old, that's because it was written back in 1825. And it has not really changed since then. But what is also helpful, as you probably noticed, it's entitled Isaiah 35th chapter, and we read Isaiah 35, and if you compare what this hymn is saying to what Isaiah 35 is saying, you'll find that it's almost identical. Well, I mean, it's setting it to poetry, but it's the same sort of idea. So if you're trying to figure out what really is going on in this hymn, a very helpful thing to do is look at Isaiah 35, because that's what John C. Brainard has tried to do. He's tried to make a poem out of Isaiah 35. And so if you're wondering, for instance, by the way, it's helpful with these things also to read the King James Version, because that's what John C. Brainard would have been using. So if if you're reading a different translation, you might wonder a bit about his language, and it's a little bit helpful to look at what did the King James say. So reading out of the King James Version, Isaiah 35, verse 1, "The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose." So this is why he said rose, because in the King James it has rose, not crocus, as you might have in other versions. And also some of the sort of stuff that you might find sort of weird language, like a wild shall echo with sounds of joy. What's a wild? Oh, he's just taken the word wilderness and shortened it a little bit to make it fit. Okay, so you can do that sort of thing, and it makes it a little more understandable. Or you can drop down to the end of Isaiah 35 and compare that to the last verse of our hymn. So the last verse of Isaiah 35, again reading out of the King James, "And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away." So you can compare that to "the ransomed of God shall return to him," almost exactly the same, with a chorus of joy to a gladsome lay, which isn't the way we'd normally say this now, but comparing, you can realize that this lay it's talking about is not like being very happy while you're lying down. It's an old word for song. So this idea of "it shall come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy." So it's a chorus of joy to a gladsome song that it's talking about. So just comparing the two is helpful for figuring out what he's saying, what's going on with the old language. I'm not going to go through the entire hymn like that, but I recommend it if you're having trouble understanding some bits. And then other parts, it's just about thinking it over. Oh, another thing I wanted to mention. You may have noticed when I read the original, he has like, it doesn't say gladsome lay, it says angel's lay. So my guess is William Osborne, I checked, and as far as I can tell, like the hymn version only has gladsome lay, and the poem version only has angel's lay. There's one hymn book from this like non-denominational church in Birmingham that has like the original poem version, so I'm not sure what happened there. But that was like before the Christadelphian hymn version. So I think it was William Osborne who actually changed that. And my guess is that he looked at verse 10 here and was like, these aren't angels who are singing. These are the redeemed who are singing. So let's not say it's an angel's lay. It's a gladsome lay because the people singing here aren't angels. Probably Mr. Brainerd was like, oh, angels singing, beautiful imagery. But William Osborne wanted to be a little more true to the text. So that's a useful thing to do. Another thing that's useful is sometimes it just takes a while to decode what is going on here, and you just think about it a little bit and say it over a few times, and you'll figure it out. So, for instance, "No eye with a tear of grief shall be dim." For a while, when I was a kid, I was like, does that mean, like, dim? What in the world is it talking about? Like, dim bulbs? They won't be stupid? What's going on? But no. If you think about it just a little bit, it's there's this expression, her eyes dimmed with tears, because what goes on is when you cry, you get tears in your eyes, and then they don't shine as brightly because you have that layer of water, and so your eyes look dim. So that's what it's saying is, because sorrow and sighing has fled away, that means that nobody's going to be crying, so no eyes are dim with tears. So no eye with a tear of grief shall be dim. Or in the original, with a tear of grief shall no eye be dim. I don't know why they changed that one around. But so that's something that was helpful for me in decoding what does this him actually mean, what's going on here. But there's some bits that are a little bit harder and to decode, and you have to do a little bit more work. One of those things is verse 2 here. Verse 2 is, "And Lebanon's cedars shall rustle their boughs and fan their leaves in the scented air, and Carmel and Sharon shall pay their vows and shout, for the glory of God is there." So my question was always, like, Carmel and Sharon shall pay their vows? Who are Carmel and Sharon, and why are they paying their vows now? Well, it turns out Carmel and Sharon are not two girls named Carmel and Sharon. Lebanon, Carmel, and Sharon are all regions in sort of the area around Israel. Lebanon, of course, is the mountain range north of Israel. Carmel is the mountain range sort of a little north of Jerusalem, close to Samaria and by the Jezreel Valley. If you know where the like jutting out portion of the coastline of Israel is. Mount Carmel's right around there. And then Sharon, I really should have brought a map. Sharon is this coastal plain along the side of Israel, sort of where Tel Aviv is now. And if you look up sort of the geography, it turns out those were all very green, fertile areas. Lebanon, to this day, is known for its cedars. If you look at the Lebanese flag, it has a cedar of Lebanon on it. Carmel, if you look it up in Wikipedia, is apparently covered with luxuriant vegetation, including oak, pine, olive, and laurel trees. And Sharon is this fertile plain along the Mediterranean, which is where the majority of Israel's population now lives, because, of course, in our modern times, what we do with good farmland is we build houses on it. So these are all the beautiful green areas of the land of Israel. And so by saying that Mount Zion would get the glory of Lebanon and Carmel and Sharon, what it's saying is that Mount Zion wasn't known for its extreme fertility. But if it's going to be like them, it's saying this is going to be an extremely green, vibrant, fertile, luxuriant area. It's a way of basically saying Zion is going to look really green and beautiful. And if we take that a little bit in context, you'll notice that the first verse of this hymn is all about things blossoming in places that are wilderness. A rose shall bloom in the lonely place. A wild shall echo with songs of joy. And it's kind of interesting. Wilderness areas. So fortunately, Israel's actually fairly like California in that the wilderness areas tend to be the dry areas where nothing grows. And so it's left wilderness because it's desert. But an interesting thing about deserts is most of the time they look lousy. They're just brown. And if you've ever been to the high desert, like north of LA or on the way to Las Vegas or Arizona, it's kind of nice on the freeway. You can see for miles in each direction because there's nothing. But if you get rain, deserts get covered by wildflowers. I don't know if you remember, a couple years ago, there were these stories about how Death Valley got rain. And this doesn't normally happen. It's one of the driest places on Earth. But because Death Valley got rain, it got absolutely covered by wildflowers. Because you don't have trees or anything to block the light. So as soon as it gets water, everything just starts to bloom. And that is the picture we're getting here in Isaiah 35 and Hymn 289. You don't normally get flowers in the wilderness. Normally it's just desert. But you get rain through there and all of a sudden the place just comes alive and is covered with wildflowers. And not the sort of things where you just like might have some flowers in the field, but the entire valley is covered. It's a carpet of them. It's absolutely gorgeous. So this idea of Lebanon cedars rustle their boughs and fan their leaves in the scented air. You know why it's scented? Because it's covered with flowers. You have this whole, so many flowers that you can smell them. So that's the picture it's painting. And it's kind of a beautiful one, isn't it? But it turns out there's even more than that going on. Because in these Lebanon, Carmel, and Sharon, these regions aren't first mentioned here in Isaiah 35. It's actually referencing back in Isaiah 33 when they're mentioned in the context, well, a somewhat different context. I'm going to turn back to Isaiah 33, and we're going to start reading at verse 7 and read Isaiah 33, 7 to 9. Only a couple pages back. Behold, their heroes cry in the streets. The envoys of peace weep bitterly. The highways lie waste. The traveler ceases. Covenants are broken. Cities are despised. There is no regard for man. The land mourns and languishes. Lebanon is confounded and withers away. Sharon is like a desert. And Bashan and Carmel shake off their leaves. Oh, isn't that interesting? So we've got Lebanon and Sharon and Carmel. Added Bashan in there, but these same three areas. And then it's also talking about highways being in terrible shape. So these same three regions, which are known for their fertility, back here in Isaiah 33, verse 9, they're like a desert. And in 33, verse 8, this highway is, it lies waste. People can't travel. Things are too dangerous or forlorn or people, the highways are no good. Everything's become a desert. In fact, if you read from Isaiah 33, in the sort of context here, it's talking about a period of devastation. All the fertile regions have been devastated because, well, let me read Isaiah 32, verses 10 through 14, which will give us a little more details. Isaiah 32, verses 10 through 14. In a little more than a year, you will shudder, you complacent women, for the grape harvest fails, the fruit harvest will not come. Tremble, you women who are at ease, shudder, you complacent ones, strip and make yourselves bare and tie sackcloth around your waist. Beat your breasts for the pleasant fields, for the fruitful vine, for the soil of my people growing up in thorns and briars. Yes, for all the joyous houses in the exultant city, for the palaces forsaken, the populous city deserted. The hill and the watchtower will become dens forever, a joy of wild donkeys, a pasture of flocks. So it's talking about things being desolate. But the reason why it's desolate, actually, is not just that there's been a drought, but because there's been an invasion. When you bring an army through an area, it destroys stuff. And this is a picture of an area that's had an army that came through, and not only did it burn stuff down, but it also killed all the people. And so you've got these areas that not only have become desolate, but they're desolate because they don't have people in there, because you've had major population reduction from having an invasion. People died in the army, or they died from the disease or anything that went with it. So people, all these areas that used to be fertile and cultivated have become wilderness. They're not being cultivated. They're not being irrigated. You don't have enough people to really take care of things. And these areas, realize it's not actually talking about Death Valley that it's talking about here. These were the nice areas. This is Mount Zion, Jerusalem itself. And this idea of a highway coming back, it's leading the captives back to Zion, back to a place that should be full of life, but had become desolate. It's painting a picture of a land coming back to life, but it's not just a land that's coming back, it's a nation coming back to life. A nation that all this stuff about it being about people being blind and lame and mute, and leaping and singing as they return home, this is a picture of people. So we have this idea of the land itself being dead, being forsaken, but it's also an idea of people who have suffered an invasion and been carried off and been destroyed and desolate, finally being coming back to life. The land's coming back to life, the people are coming back to life, and it's all this sort of picture of what was dead, devastated, destroyed, coming back to life. And why is it coming back to life? What's changed? Well, as it says in verse 3 of this hymn, God has come back to save them. The God who had seemed to have forsaken them, who had allowed their land to be devastated and the nation to be carried off captive, the God who had in some ways disappeared and left them for dead, he was back and with vengeance, but not for them, but for their enemies. Isaiah 34 actually has this extended section about how God would take vengeance on the land of Edom, how the land of Edom would be left a desert, but the land of Israel, which was a desert at this point, wouldn't be left a desert anymore. It would blossom like a rose. It would be like wilderness that is covered with wildflowers. It's this picture of a land that had been in some ways dead coming back to life, a nation that had been dead coming back to life. That's the picture he's painting. And the interesting question then to ask is, when does this apply? We've got this picture of essentially resurrection, resurrection of a land, resurrection of a people. But what resurrection? Is this talking about the Assyrian invasion? I mean, that's definitely Isaiah's immediate historical context. If you go to the very next chapter, it's going to talk about, came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the defense cities of Judah. That is the immediate context. The Assyrians were going to come down. They were going to devastate the land. They were going to destroy most of the cities of Israel and carry off people into captivity. But at the same time, Jerusalem didn't really go into captivity during the Assyrian invasion. That was more when the Babylonians came. When the Babylonians came, that really devastated Zion. The Assyrian invasion, Jerusalem and Zion were saved, but the Babylonians came, they burned down the temple, and they left Jerusalem a ruin. And then it was with the return of the exiles under Cyrus that you actually had sort of this idea of the ransom, the redeemed of the Lord coming back to Jerusalem. Psalm 126 describes almost the same scene of captives returning with songs of joy. But at the same time of Ezra and Nehemiah, you have captives coming back to Jerusalem, but you don't actually have sort of miraculous healing of people. This idea of like the blind, the eyes of the blind being opened and the ears of the deaf being unstopped. That doesn't happen until Jesus comes and literally does everything that it mentions in that verse. That's kind of neat. If you go through the Gospels, he does every single one of those things. He heals the blind man in John 9. He heals a deaf man in Mark 7. He heals a lame man in John 5. He heals a mute person in Luke 11. Jesus legitimately does each of these things and even tells John the Baptist's disciples that he is deliberately doing all of those things. And so you can look at this as Jesus who's coming and bringing true salvation to those in bondage, bringing this hope of eternal life, and that's the picture it's painting. But at the same time, Jesus didn't actually redeem Jerusalem. Jerusalem was destroyed just under a generation after his coming, and the Jews carried away into captivity, and they haven't been able to return until the last 100 years, where sort of around the independence of Israel. Israel has finally become a country again. You have had Jews coming from around the world back to live in their homeland again. It's kind of interesting, actually. Thanks to their irrigation programs, they literally have been making the desert bloom. If you ever look at a satellite map of Jerusalem, you'll be able to very clearly see where the barrier is between sort of the Jewish West Jerusalem and the Arab East Jerusalem. And because if you look at Jewish West Jerusalem, there's all these like weird greenish shadows everywhere. It's like, why is it that East Jerusalem all looks like very bright and West Jerusalem is all sort of shadowed? So you zoom way in and you figure out these are all from trees. There are trees all over the Jewish areas, and the Arab areas are all brown and sort of just desert-like. Literally, the Jews flowing back in the land are making the land of Israel bloom. The Jewish areas are green and cultivated and nice, and the Arab areas are still brown and dead. But at the same time, there's no true holiness in Jerusalem right now. It's a secular city and a secular country, and like I was saying, it's divided very clearly in half. This is not a place which is full of safety, where there's a way of holiness leading back in. The Palestinian areas are definitely not always safe for travelers. So when does this chapter apply? What is the immediate context? What's going on? And certainly, as Ben said, this will apply in the kingdom. This picture of a Jerusalem where people are able to return, where you have miraculous things being done, where the land is truly become fruitful again, that will apply in the kingdom. And there's a reason why in all our hymn books it says Christ, his kingdom at the top, because this is a kingdom hymn. It's looking forward to that. But I think also the way I just described that, there are many ways you can see this fulfilled throughout history, but not completely fulfilled. I think there's a pattern here. God likes bringing dead things back to life. And so this picture of something that was dead coming back to life, he does that. This is the work of God. And even though it's not fulfilling every bit of Isaiah 35, that was clearly the work of God in bringing the captives back to Jerusalem after the Babylonian captivity. It's clearly the work of God, Jesus coming and healing people at his first coming. It's clearly the work of God, the Jews coming back to the land in the past 100 years as part of the state of Israel. This is all clearly the work of God. So we can go, this is a way that God works. This sort of idea of making dead things come to life, blossoming, making wildflowers spring up in a desert. He created a world where that happens, where you have things that become dead and worthless, and then you get something in there from the heavens. Rain comes down, and then poof, all of a sudden life comes out. That's a way God works. And I think that's a glorious thing to see, not only looking forward to the kingdom when this will all truly be fulfilled, but also look for it in smaller manifestations as well. This idea of God taking something that's dead, lifeless, worthless, and bringing it to life, making it beautiful again. He does this all over this place. And I think it's good and right to rejoice the same way we're seeing people do in this hymn. When, say, something happens in your life, when he takes an obstacle or a stumbling block away, when you see somebody who seems to have become dead and like not stony ground, like the pathway where things are just bouncing off and they're not interested, not listening, and then something happens and they come to life and start hearing again. This is all the same picture. This picture of dead things coming to life. It's the work of God. And so, yes, this is looking forward to the kingdom, and we can look forward to this. But at the same time also, I feel like it's a beautiful picture of just the way God works. Although clearly, in the kingdom, there will be a resurrection, and a lot of dead things are going to come back to life. And something I think is interesting to speculate a little bit about is, Brother William Osborne was a Christadelphian. I'm pretty sure in the resurrection, we're going to have Brother William Osborne there. But it's also interesting, this John Gardner Calkins Brainerd, who wrote the poem, like I said, a lot of information about him out there, detailed memoirs, and it's interesting when you read his sort of biography, it turns out that although he had always been sort of a religious person, this is not his only poem that was based on a religious thing. He's got a lot of poetry, I didn't read all of it, but you can clearly tell this man was brought up in a religious household. But it's interesting reading his biography. Turns out he died really young. He died at the age of 31 to tuberculosis. But it says that before he died, he sort of had this sort of spiritual revival where he devoted his life to Christ. He was baptized, which I thought was interesting because most people would have been baptized as babies back then. But he deliberately, it says, was baptized. And it talks about how he devoted his life to Christ and was saying that he knew at this point that he wasn't healthy, but he was going to devote whatever he had to Christ. And I was like, that sounds pretty cool. Maybe, I don't know, I'm not God, but maybe in the resurrection we'll have him as well. And of course we'll have the prophet Isaiah. And so, I don't know, it's speculation, but I have this sort of picture of perhaps in the resurrection, we'll have the person who wrote the words, and the person who wrote the music, and the person who wrote the original prophecy, all getting to sing this hymn together in that great choir of the saints who are resurrected at the resurrection of our Lord. So, it's a picture. It's a picture I like looking forward to, and it's something that I'm going to think of now every time I read, well, and sing Hymn 289, A Rose Shall Bloom in the Lonely Place. Hopefully you will too now. Thank you.